Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Addiction... That's not right. Drug Use Addiction and Recovery Channel and the New Books Network. This is Jay Schiffman, founder of the Choose Your Struggle podcast and its related content. But this isn't about me. We're here with an incredible author, a guy that I'm just so delighted to chat with. It is Randall Horton, who is the author of Dead Weight. It's a memoir and essays is what it says on the cover. But as you're going to hear, it really felt to me almost more like poetry. It is a beautifully written book, and I'm just delighted. Randall, anything else you want to say about yourself before we launch into this?
No, I think we'll pretty much scan the scope of in terms of me and, you know, in terms of a person and my geographical location and all that kind of stuff as it relates to the book and what that means. So I'm just excited to be here and talk with you and, you know, talk about the book, man. So, yeah, I mean, let's have that conversation.
Well, to the listeners, this is not the typical book we cover on this channel. There is, no pages worth of facts and figures. This is a guy in Mr. Horton here who lived this. This is a guy who saw this topic that we cover on this channel from multiple angles. And this novel or this memoir collection of stories is so deeply, deeply personal. And that's one of the reasons I almost felt like it was more poetry is that you I finished this and I said, man, I really feel like I know this guy. You know, was that something you set out to do in this book? Were you... I know being vulnerable isn't always a conscious choice, but was it something that you considered when you were writing this?
Well, yes, I did. I wanted to expose myself a little bit more than I had in my first memoir. And as I was, thinking about, the things that I wanted to talk about and how I wanted to tell them, I realized that in order for the reader to go on me with this journey, they had to sort of feel what I was going through, really. You know what I mean? And so I had to take that leap of faith just for the sake of the reader, because, it is a scary, it is an interesting situation when you expose yourself in those ways, right? But also in the memory comes sort of like the baptismal, right? So, you get that too, right? So, yeah.
Well, what I found so fascinating too is that it wasn't just you that I felt I knew. I felt I knew your family. I felt I knew the people you ran with because, right. I want to get into some of the details about your family in particular because, man, I tell you, I wish I knew Big 70. I wish I could have hung out with Big 70 and Rosie Lee in particular. And your mother, Eunice, is just, she felt like such a caring and loving person.
Right, these
characters jumped out of this book. And like I said, like I wanted to hang out with them. I wanted to run with Big 70.
Yeah, that was... important to me to sort of make these the people that I was talking about historically come alive in a way in which you understood the condition in which they were in. And, you know, and you're talking about growing up in Birmingham and coming up in what they call sort of like a juke joint or a shot house. You know what I mean? Think about The Color Purple and Sug, right? So, and, you know, and so that was my grandmother. And so there was a host of characters that I never forgot that sort of stuck with me. And I just, they're embedded in my memory. And I wanted to, you know, I wanted to bring them, you know, to life, and so people could understand, you know, the ways in which I sort of came up, but also the love that was there underneath all of that strife and, you know, racial conflict and, you know, sort of like coming up from the bottom, as they say, or the so-called common element, as I say, with Langston Hughes's essay, when I go there. And, you know, yeah, all the way from Big 70, all the way to Bud and Dennis in 1912, the shootout and, you know. And so, but getting back to your point, I think for me, it was, and even later on when I began to talk about my more deeper personal, you know, stories and that thing, to sort of the people I'm talking about, so these are the people that, you know, oftentimes are discussed when we talk critically about, you know, what it meant to be sort of early participant in, you know, the prison industrial complex, or, you know, getting involved in the criminal justice system, right? And so it's that kind of narrative that we talk about in many ways with the new Jim Crow, or you think about another book called Until We Reckon, and you have these sort of examples of like what happened and what went down. Well, these are the people that were there. And, you know, there's another layer to that in terms of their, you know, their story and why they're there and the things that led them to be in those situations, right, in which, you know, they became part of, you know, what I like to call a national narrative, which involved, you know, of course, cocaine, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that was important to me all the way through, for sure.
So, and I guess, please tell me if I'm reading too much into this, but was there meant to be a bit of a mirroring in the way that you described Big 70s experience with moonshine and your own experience, as we'll get to in a minute? Sorry to the listeners, we're kind of spoiling this a minute here, but we are gonna talk about Randall's experience running cocaine in a minute. But was there meant to be a bit of when you described it, sort of as in like, yeah, these were a little bit similar in the way that this went down?
Yes, it wasn't. Yeah, I mean, I wasn't deliberate with that because I think I begin to sort of, I mean, put those dots together as, you know, as I begin to think about the history of my family and what would, you know, what would transpire through several generations, and some of those relatives that stuck out, you know, that stuck out in terms of they went to prison, or there was, you know, involved in something, you know what I mean? And so I wanted to trace that, you know, all the way up until me, you know, because I talk about how I skipped a generation with my father, you know, and then, you know, but just as much as that influence from Big 70, of course, that was, you know, and all of that. I think, you know, Rosalie, on the other hand, my grandmother, the lady who, you know, kind of raised me from a kid, you know, when she was watching me and I was in this house and I got to see, you know, adulthood straight up from the, you know, from, you know, as a young kid, man. I mean, like, I was 8 years old pouring shots of liquor, you know what I mean? And so you got to understand 50 cent shots and dollar shots of red and white. And it just, you know, I was sort of, you know, that's just the world I grew up in, man. That's all. What can I say? But the flip side of that, there was a sort of love, and there wasn't anything like, I wasn't like to go willy nilly out and do anything. She had a strong hand on me. Mm-hmm. Trust me. I think, you know, maybe she was preparing me for, you know, understanding, like, even more so than anybody else, like what I was going to have to go through, later on in life, you know what I mean? In ways that my mother, you know, did not or could not at that time, you know what I mean? So,
and you used a phrase just a minute ago that I love, because this is so evident in the book that it does skip a generation. You know, you're talking about your grandfather, Big 70, and yeah. Rosie Lee. And then your mother is this sort of almost angelic presence throughout the book. Right. You know, she's the only person that really came to visit you when you were in jail. You know, you talk about the conversations where she's the one putting money in your pocket when you're in jail and all that.
Right.
And so she isn't that character like your grandmother.
And
you were really specific. It almost felt like that the difference was education. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it was, because I think my grandmother even understood that. And it was a collective effort to get my mother in college from a very young age. You have to understand this, you know? And so, you know, my mother's mother was in the bootleg business too. It was an inherited thing, you know what I mean? So it was really like a lineage. Like, so my mother's next in line for that. That's the lot in life. You know, my grandmother started doing it at 16.
Wow.
See what I'm saying? So, what happened was, we had an uncle that had gone to college some kind of way and ended up was a principal. And he had a hand in, and then it became this collective effort to get my mother to college and sort of keep her out of that life. And so, you know, it's something that she doesn't necessarily talk about a lot either. But I think that those experiences growing up in that, I know it shaped, you know, her will and determination in a way that I never could probably understand until, like, I talk about in the essay, you know, Mother's Love, right? I don't think I could understand it until that point, you know what I mean? What she, you know, everything that she had to go through, and, you know, and here was this woman that sort of achieved all this stuff through education and, you know, was president of the Alabama Education Association, had been doing work with the NEA and, you know, et cetera, right? And so, and it wasn't like she had tried not to instill those things in me. It was just like, I just got caught up in something that, you know, it was just bigger than it. It was just, you know, something no one saw coming, especially me. And it took a span of almost, what, 30 years, 20 something years, 25 years, something like that, to sort of, you know, get back to, you know, what I was really supposed to be doing in this world, you know, basically.
And you know, again, sorry, listeners, we're going to spoil the ending here, but you are back to that. And as you so famously say in this, in a couple places on your website, that you're the only tenured professor in the U.S. with 7 felony convictions. So congrats to that.
Yeah.
But before we get to that, one more point about your childhood that I just found fascinating. And that was the story that you share in here about being sort of almost a test subject in integrating schools. Your mother, this was important to her.
Right.
And, you know, it sounded like, though, that it was a little less successful for you. Is that right?
Yeah, it was a little less successful for me. And the interesting thing about, so me and my mother were part of that first wave of integration in the county system of Birmingham, Alabama, in 1973, even though they should have done it like years earlier. They waited till the last moment. And in the process of it, you know, I come to find out years later, my mom was telling me about it. The principal, you know, asked around all the black principals, like, who are the teachers that you don't want to give up, right? And my mom was one of them, and so she got requested to the school because they wanted the best, you know, man. And so so she became, so I came, so we went to this, you know, we integrated a school. And it was a very interesting experience, man. I went with her because, you know, I always went to the schools where my mother was teaching as a young kid. So, you know, that's babysitting, you know, right there, like, you know, so, but, I ended up being, you know, the only kid like in the third grade, that was of color, black. Well, at that time, man, I just have to be, you know, it was just black and white and black and white existence. I didn't even know like other colors or that kind of diversity was kind of almost foreign to me. But even, you know, having, you know, been insulated in a very segregated community that was segregated through segregation, you know, and, you know, walking, you know, and living in those neighborhoods and existing in this other kind of world. And then all of a sudden being transitioned into something that is, you know, very eye-opening, to say the least. And like I talk about, I'm going to talk about in the book, you know, they come, you know, they came that moment there that I sort of, you know, like to sort of make a parallelism to James Baldwin when he talks about in that debate in William Buckley, I think it's 64, in Oxford. He's talking about the plight of is the American dream at the expense of the American Negro or something like that. But anyway, he talks about the moment that you realize that race, that there's a race, that race, you understand the concept of race a little bit better. Like you get to understand that we're not all in this very utopian society as little kids and everybody just playing and having a good time. Like, and then you become, you know, you understand that, you know, there are people who actually, you know, despise you because you look a different kind of way. And you look different, you talk different, you know what I mean? You have a different culture. And so that's what kind of what happened in that, you know, I talk about the situation where I got in a little girl called me the N-word and, you know, there was I hit her and there was this whole thing at the school where, and at the time I didn't realize, you know, the significance of the event, like I talk about, in terms of what happened to the little black boy to do something like that to, you know, to a white girl. Cause I hit her in the jaw when she called me, you know, the N word, on the playground, man, we're kids, man. And so my mother was, you know, had always told me, if anyone did that, you know, like you fight back and man, you know, and so, but at the same time, you know, I understood the idea of like hitting a little girl, like that's some real, you know, like that's some jacked up stuff. And that was the one thing, and you know, that was the one thing up until, you know, all through, since I was probably 2 years old, you don't hit girls, you know what I mean? And so like, I knew that and I understood that. And like, you know, and so I understood that part of it too. And so it just was a, you know, traumatic, like I said, it was a traumatic event in terms of what I had to go through. And you know, I understood that I hadn't really done anything wrong when my mother stuck up for me. You know what I mean? Because she's not the kind of woman that's going to stick up for you if she thinks that you're wrong in any kind of way. She wants you to learn from your mistake. You know, to make it put it mildly, like she don't spare the rod with that. But when she, you know, stuck up for me in a way that, you know, up until that point, like in terms of school and teachers and things like that, man, I knew something, you know, I knew it was like, oh, wow, you know, this is some real stuff right here, you know. And then I talked, you know, I would talk to my dad years later, man. He was telling me, man, all the other stuff that was going on, man, and, you know, behind the scenes is like, you know, this is, you know, so you never know, man, you know. And, you know, so those are the things that you, you know, as a kid, these underlining narratives that you, you know, in terms of my narrative that I sort of, was, you know, had to sort of discover digging through this memoir, right? So, yeah.
And so I can't even, obviously, even one iota imagine the trauma of that experience. And you so beautifully put it in the book as you talk about your mom, but you also talk about your dad's reaction to finding out what happened. Yeah. And that's sort of you're hinting to the reader, like, this is a big, like, this was a big deal. Was how your dad responded. And sort of on a bigger context for the book, for a book that's only, I was just looking at this, 130 something pages, you somehow packed so much beauty into this book. And it's, you do so without wasting a single word, right? It's very sort of like the sun also rises in that sense, in that, you know, it is, there is not one word out of place. It is just beautiful throughout. Uh-huh. And you mix these stories so expertly where you're talking about this and that kind of next thing we know, you're at Howard, right? Which is where you started. Right. And you're getting into to drugs. And it was just, it again, to go back to my earlier point, it was such a beautiful way to let people in, to help the reader feel like they knew you a little bit.
Right, right. And that was important too, you know. So, I mean, I'm a real... You know, I guess when you talk about craft now in terms of as a writer, I'm very interested in point of view and how that lens rotates for the writer and the reader actually throughout the, you know, the narrative. And so a lot of times I'm very conscious of trying to alter that lens in ways in which it's fluid and to get to one thing to another. And even if they don't necessarily make sense in the beginning, like the connection, but they do connect, you know what I mean? You know, everything connects. And so in some kind of way, but that is kind of, you know, so that was, you know, and as a poet too, man, you know, it's like, I was really, you know, interested in, you know, the imagery in the book, and the way that I, you know, talked about things metaphorically, obviously. And, but also with it, I have to say I had a good editor too. That saved me from, cause you know, as a poet, you know, you probably sometimes you're going to get a little bit too, you know, you're going to do a little bit too much here, a little bit too much there. And so that's why it was important. No, seriously. That's why it was important. That, you know, that the editor that we chose, that they chose for this project, she understood what I was trying to do, but at the same time, we understood that we had to reach, we had to keep the reader present, ever present, you know. And so I think she helped me do that in some, you know, places, in a lot of places. And I think it just was made, you know, made for a great read for me, you know. So, yeah, yeah.
Well, I completely agree. And I think it says something that, you know, this is a channel that where we talk about drugs, and you and I are over 20 minutes into this conversation and we haven't even gotten to the drugs yet, right? But that's a testament to this book, is that it is about drugs, but it isn't about drugs. It's about you. It's about people. Yeah. And it's about forces larger than us. And I think that, you know, I'm getting a little ahead of myself here, but I love that it ends on, and I'm going to butcher the name of this area. Is it Eleuthera? Is that how you pronounce
Eleuthera. It? Yes, it's okay. Eleuthera. Yes,
so right. I never even heard of that, but it that was such an important location. And it ends with you talking to your connect down there about the way the U.S. government was involved in drugs and drug running. And, was so fascinating. And you saved it to literally the end of the book. And you know, in other books, that would be a story in itself. That would be a major storyline, or that would be the first chapter. Right. And again, it says so much about the way you chose to write this, that that was almost an afterthought. That, oh, right, this incredible point about drugs can come in the last couple of pages.
Right, right. Now, that was sort of important for me, too, to sort of say that had to be the end. But the other things were much more important. But, you know, in other ways. And so I needed to, you know, show the whole picture. I don't want to, like, keep the focus on me so much that I got into this whole idea of glorifying the idea of drugs, too. And I was, you know, kind of, you know, ever present of that, too. And I wanted to talk about some of the real consequences that come from, you know, having been inside that world for so long. And, you know, but you have to talk about things, obviously. And so, and But, you know, ultimately, I couldn't, I had to write that piece. I think it just, you know, made sense, I mean, to me to write it after, especially after I'd been watching Snowfall. And I began to think about, you know, we talking about this whole idea of there's, there was this West Coast presence, CIA government and government back, you know, things that in terms of, you know, having cocaine available to cast, you know, to buy and spread into the communities or whatever. And I began to think about, you know, what I experienced, you know, on the East Coast in terms of that island, because it was a halfway fueling point between South America and Miami at the time. And it was one of the places where Carlos Lera, one of the original cocaine cowboys, actually had set up shop before he got his own island. And so it was a very interesting place. But, you know, it all starts with me at Howard. And, you know, I have a room, I had a roommate, a friend of, you know, roommate slash one of my best friends, you know, and his father was into a whole lot of that. And long story short, I ended up on that island, you know what I mean? And so, it became part of that whole thing. But I became friends with, and where we're going with this, I became friends with these two guys who, you know, was going back and forth at that time. And they were into some heavy stuff. And so it just got me to thinking about, you know, at the time, I'm not thinking to ask these questions. You know, these are not the questions I'm going to be asking, you know, these guys. And, but, you know, I could ask them that because we remained friends for over like 20 something years, man. And so it wasn't even about drugs, or more so than I think they, you know, we had a mutual respect for each other and just a friendship. Because when we met, I didn't even know that they were doing that. That was something that just sort of came a little bit later. And to be truth be told, I didn't participate a lot with them in terms of that because they were on a whole nother level, but I received some of the residuals, you know what I mean? So, and I was, you know, and so it was one of those things too, but it got me to thinking to go down there and but it's also a beautiful place to write too. And I knew I was going to do two things. I was going to continue working on my memoir. I mean, these essays or whatever, you know, and I was going to talk. I was going to talk to him, and get the real deal in terms of like the things that I never asked him, you know, about this whole thing. You know what I mean? And because you know, he's told me some. Like the first time, I think when I wrote my first memoir, he talked about, you know, how he got into the whole thing in South America on a fluke. You know what I mean? I think I talk about that in this book too. I kind of give a brief review of like how he got started in Nassau. And him and his brother. You know, they became, you know, two cats that were like dependent upon, they could fly planes and, you know, they could drive boats and they could do all of that stuff nautical. You know what I mean? They were all, they were some interesting guys. You know, and so I knew what they were doing. So when I went down and I talked to my connect about that. And he gave me some fascinating stories, man. And one of them, you know, he just sort of like, he talked about, you know, the whole government, you know, connect and just like being able to sort of move freely, you know, between, you know, what he was doing, you know, which was not necessarily, you know, he had told me things before in which, you know, he had been, you know, offered to do his thing, you know, if he just, you know, gave up a person to here or there, you know what I mean? This was back in the day though, you know, so I knew about that. So, but I didn't necessarily know that there was this thing about helping them get cocaine, you know, from South America, you know, come to grips with like, you know, the devastation that came from that time period, the devastation that I was part of, the devastation that I did to myself and others. And I'm looking, you know, I think part of that whole, you know, that writing this piece and even going back there, you know, was still trying to come to grips with that or seek forgiveness in some kind of way for myself. But I tell you what, and I even talk about in the book, one of the things that I realized, and even talking to a lot of people, you know, that, you know, that's there, you know, in that region or whatever, like the way they look at, you know, what happened during that time period is a little bit different, you know, than the way we kind of look at it as a nation. And I think, you know, and it becomes a different lens. I don't think they hold the same, like, you know, like to them, it's like they, you know, they were participating in something that, you know, they thought that was, they had to do to survive almost because of, you know, the way they were living.
But was that different than how you felt at certain times during this? Because there,
No, it wasn't.
And you did such a great job of at one point really showing that this idea of a separation between a drug user and a drug dealer is silly. I mean, right. you were struggling with it with a form of addiction towards the end of your run, and you were also still working really hard to sell enough drugs that you could use some yourself.
Exactly. So that was the whole thing. You know, I was involved in the world in that where I knew that I could participate in it and use. And still, like, you know, be somewhere where I guess top would be or whatever that meant to be. But then when I failed, I fell hard. I fell hard and fast. And, you know, I fell and I did these depths of homelessness and despair and sleeping in, you know, cars, man, and waking up every day in the homeless shelters, going to daily work, daily pay gigs. Trying to make it, you know what I mean? And so I drew myself into this funk. And that's the other part of it too, you know what I mean? And it would be these times where that would happen. And so that's why it was important for me to talk about those. You can't tell that story without telling, you know, the flip side of it and like what it all ultimately means. Like, okay, yeah, all of that sounds good. But, you know, these are the things that's really going to happen to you, right? And these are the things, these are the people that you're going to hurt. And these are the, you know, the ways in which it's going to affect your life for a long time. And so you're going to have to climb out of a hole that you sort of, you know, that you dug for yourself. Yeah, man. And so all of that was important, you know, to get to that point. As I'm talking about reevaluation, you know, because I do talk about it in a way that sort of brings that thing to life that we talk about in terms of running drugs from South America all the way through Haiti, you know what I mean, to Cuba, you know, up through Miami, you know, going all the way up through 95, the pipeline, and then ultimately into Canada, you know? So, yeah.
So So my listeners know that I'm also in recovery, and I didn't run anywhere near as hard as you did. but the piece to me in this that really was just, I think, brutal, but also so expertly related was about the shooting in the trap house in which you lost some people that you knew. And
oh man, yeah,
like that was something that. I said, you know, I obviously didn't have to live through anything like that, but I know people who had similar experiences. But I think that the average reader would just think of this as another world, right? But you did such a beautiful job of helping people smell it and feel it and see it.
Yeah.
That if you're okay with it, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, 1303 T Street. I had to talk about it because, you know, it was a situation in which, you know, I lost a friend and almost lost another friend I had one friend go to jail for like almost 17 and a half years. And I had a friend of mine that lose his house. And I had another. Yeah. And so it was tragic. So this 1303 TC represented like that moment that sort of kind of changed my lot when I had fell on hard times and I was homeless and I was out on the street and I was, you know, just sort of had given up because, you know, my connected went to jail. I had stopped. It was just like one of those things where I fell into this spiral of addiction where I didn't know where I was going, man. I just woke up every day just to exist among the living, to be honest with you. I knew where to go get the free breakfasts. I knew where to go get the, you know, the lunch and the dinner, you know. So, you know, that place called So Others May Eat. You know, they had Martha's Food Wagon, you know what I mean? And so I knew how to get to all of them, trust me. And I would be up under this tree, man, you know, and just hanging out to wait to go to the shelter. And, you know, I had found a couple of little cats, and so we run the night a little bit and then go check in the shelter, right? But I got to be friends with a guy named John, John Glenn, and he would always pass by. He had a job. He was working. He was doing some kind of electrical thing, but he was taking classes at UDC, right? And I had dropped out of college and stuff like that, but he would stop and talk to us and stuff like that, man. And, you know, and eventually, man, he invited me down to his crib. Where, you know, he was staying with his pops in that house. And, you know, one thing led to another, man. He asked his dad, could, you know, they had a pretty nice sized house, right? And it was just him, his dad, and his Aunt Celie. You know, she was an older woman. She was almost bedridden at that time. And could I move in and stay with them to get myself together? And he let it happen. And he said yes. And so I began to change my, you know, so sometimes you do need a little helping hand. And, you know, John was able to do that. But going forward, I end up leaving that house. And my friend, who's actually going to be part of my book release tonight. My book release is actually tonight. And so Gary, when I left the house, I was back in that life, right? And Gary needed a place to stay. And ended up moving there. And then a couple of months after that, I think his father died, and then Unseelie had to be moved to a home. So it was just them two. And then I think a couple of my friends, Steve, moved in. And then, but there was another guy named Donnie from the neighborhood that we were all friends with. And he would come by, you know, play PlayStation. He would watch, you know, do the video games and stuff like that. And and I used to come over there, and I would always come back and visit, you know, because, you know, John was like a really good friend of mine at that time, and we still keep in touch. I would end up getting arrested, you know what I mean? And I was in the system, and I woke up one day. We was in the day room. I think it was like 10 o'clock and it was breaking news. And they was talking about a shootout on 13th and T Street. And it was like, and I already knew what it was, right? I knew that something bad had happened in that house. I knew. And my friend Gary had to fight for his life. My friend Donnie lost his life. My friend John had to jump out a second floor window with another friend of his to escape. My friend Steve got sliced up with a machete, man. It's crazy, right? And it was a setup. And, you know, on any given night, there's supposed to be me there. You know, I know that. I mean, it just does. And I could never stop thinking about how, you know, how fate and, you know, circumstance, you know, like fate is like, I'm locked up. I'm incarcerated. right? And, you know, and we don't talk about how prison saves your life like that, you know? And so as I began to talk to, you know, and so Gary ended up getting like 17 years for conspiracy. And, you know, John lost that house, and Steve, you know, I talked to him, you know, years later, man. And, you know, it was one of the most, you know, I could tell, like, when he was trying to tell the story, that it was like, it was difficult for him even then to even think about it. And I knew then that I was going to write about it. And I had to talk. I had to sort of, like, you know, work that out. You know, something that happened, you know, to some good friends of mine, and how, you know, being part of that life, man, that's what that brings. That's the result. You know what I mean? So he talking about the end game. That's the end game, man. You know, and I think, man, almost two to three months later, man, Gary's in prison with me. See what I'm saying? And so so
we don't want to give away all the details because we want people to read it. But you do such a beautiful job of, yes, you talk about those low moments, some of the high moments that you had, you know, great experiences. But I think the next question I want to ask that I feel like is on, at least on my mind, mm-hmm. hearing you talk about these experiences and reading the book for myself is, what did it mean to you to revisit that time now as a tenured professor, as a multi-time published author, as a poet, being able to look back from as safe as we, any of us ever are, and knowing that, you know, you flip a coin 1,000 times and maybe it's only coming up this way that one time, right? I mean, what did it mean to you to have the opportunity to look back and write about this now?
Man, it's almost humbling in a way, you know, because sometimes I think when you go through, you know, experiences like that, you're like wondering, what is your purpose going to be in life, right? You're wondering, like, will I be able to outlive some of these memories and some of this guilt that I've, you know, had to live with or in process and some in every kind of way imaginable. And I think, but also understanding that for me, man, it was like, you know, even it, so here we get, so here's where the, you know, where language and writing comes in too, right? Because, you know, as I was in this process, I think, and especially when I was in prison, I became, you know, really interested in how writing was beginning to change my life, too. How I was beginning to find a moral compass, and how I was beginning to, you know, think of things in a more human manner, man, and give in terms of people and myself, even myself, man. I had to forgive myself in that process as well. But I think writing did that. And so writing has always been a big part, you know, going through my recovery process in that, you know, trying to write, you know, coming out of prison and trying to, you know, start, you know, create a life for myself. And so consequently, revisiting that past through the lens, through a sort of lens that I've had a chance to adjust and readjust and think about in various ways, you know, from some, you know, for 10 to 15 years. So like, what did it all really mean? Right. I think sometimes we write about experiences in ways that we're not necessarily ready to talk about. And we talk about them anyway. And I think, but for me, In telling these stories, it took a minute. Like I think people assume, well, I don't know if they assume when I take that back, but oftentimes people think that, you know, these are the only, you know, I've been writing about incarceration, you know, or, you know, addiction, you know, my whole, you know, entire, you know, career, you know, as sort of writing books. But I haven't, you know what I mean? I really haven't, you know what I mean? My first three books, were about, you know, poetry, they were really about something totally different. And it wasn't until my memoir, the first one, Hook, a memoir, that I really began to get into this whole thing in ways in which, because I felt I was ready to sort of get at it. And you talk about dead weight and it being like 130-some pages. Well, I think that's the compression of language and really understanding what every word meant, what every feeling meant, and what, you know, what everything meant, and sort of trying to, as I was trying to construct this narrative. So no word is left unspent. You know, as I'm going back, I'm looking at it obviously through the lens of a poet. But I'm also, and I say, you know, I'm trying to break free just as much as I'm trying to help the reader break free. Maybe I'm trying to break us all free, you know? I don't know, but I know I'm always on that journey, looking for like the answer. And, you know, sometimes we find it and sometimes we really don't. We're just left with the experience, right? And that's why it's important for me to tell the experience. And so I think as I'm looking back, now I'm able to, you know, look at it through all of the experiences I've had and the ways in which I've been able to, rebuild my life and sort of be more confident in telling that story too. As you know, that's important as well. In addition to just sort of excavating that truth and telling it in a way that's honest and as a writer, you know. So I'm after a lot of things in that. I think that's an interesting question, the way you pose it and to talk about, you know, because I think, you know, in reflection, you know, there are a lot of things at play, you know, and especially when in the memoir, when you're dealing with memoirish things, there's a lot, just a lot of things at play. So, but yeah.
Well, I love that you said it was sort of no word, you know, unspent. And sort of to my earlier point of it is very Hemingway in that sense, although it's more as if Hemingway was a poet because you allowed there to be beauty, not just through, you know, Hemingway was famous for having sort of no time for flowery language. That was something that he just felt was not, there was no room for that in his writing. But you are able to just as beautifully as he does, be concise yet also descriptive, and I love right. that about this book. Yeah. And it is very poetic in that sense. Right. The last question I'll get before, obviously, we want to finish with where people can buy it and find out more about you and all that. But before we get to that, you know. You are not, as I said at the beginning, the average person we talk to on this channel. But more than that, you this sort of honest telling of your experiences is sadly unique in the literary scene. Mm-hmm. Are there other people that you look at and go, yeah, they're doing it right in terms of talking about incarceration and talking about an honest look at what, you know, the sort of above street level dealing actually looks like? Is there anyone else that you would recommend to listeners to go check out?
Well, I mean, Mitchell Jackson's The Residue Years is probably an interesting novel, and it gets at a lot of what is symptomatic. That's not the right word. It gets a lot to what happened to generation after what we went through in the 80s. I think it sort of like brings that whole generation to life through a couple of characters. And the effects of that, and how, you know, one protagonist gets into the life, through, you know, and is dealing with the mother's addiction. Right. Yeah. So when I read that book, I was like, boom, that's it. Mitchell just won the Pulitzer too.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He did a piece on the, Ahmaud Arbery case, I forget the name of it now, but it's an interesting piece, man. I love it. But that, so The Residue Years, for sure, man. Yeah, that book gets, and I mean, I'm kind of, it's not a whole lot, you know what I mean? I'm kind of lost the words of that, mm-hmm. you know, who gets at that time period in the way that I say, yeah, they got it right. Are they?
Can I ask though, yeah. because that was, I agree with you, and that is so startling to me that this is something we you know, we, to be frank, we read about you in the news more than we've heard from you, right? Does that sort of hit home? Is that,
yeah.
I don't mean you as a person, I mean this story.
Right.
And so my question is, why, as someone who is one of the few voices, I think, from this we are being able to hear from, why are you so unique? Why is it so that we're not hearing more Randall Hortons telling these stories?
That's an interesting thing, man. I don't know. It's hard to say. I look around and it's just not, the community is less than four on my fingers, you know what I mean? If I got a four finger hand, I got too many.
We laugh, but it's also very sad.
So sad, man. No, I'm saying, and even so, okay. So, Melina, dig this though. You think about that, but then the flip side of it: where are the women at?
That great point.
Boom.
Yeah,
and then that's a whole another conversation when you start talking about, you know, the women's voices from the inside.
And the women in your story are very. There's a spectrum from your mother to mm-hmm. the people you knew on the street, which was, you know, to be frank, hard to read at times, talking right. about some of the women at that in that period.
Yeah, man. I mean, yeah. I think we tend to forget, you know, the effects of that the drug had, you know, on the body. But it goes both, you know, men and women. You know, we talk, well, the people who identify, you know, however they do sexually, whatever, being able to, you know, going out and selling their body for that. That was real. And it was, you know, and sometimes it was sad because you would see people that you knew, you know, relatives or people that's just out there and not even caring enough, you know, about their own self. The self, it doesn't matter anymore. You know, they become like sort of this ghost of who they were, right? And, you know, a lot of times I'm trying to talk about that time period and create that in some of these things, man. And you know, and like I can never forget some of those things. Those scenes are like very vivid in my mind. And people walking around with denied whole eyes, and you know, 12 or 1 o'clock in the morning, man. And it's like these nomadic. Involved in this whole nomadic scene of like nothingness, man. It's like. And to get caught up in that, and you, yeah, man, it's just like some crazy stuff. So I don't know.
Well, it's a powerful read, the book. And again, mm-hmm. listeners, the book is Dead Weight, a memoir and essays by Randall Horton. Randall, if you wouldn't mind shouting out where people can find you online, where they can buy the book, anything else that the listeners need to know about you and where they can support you.
Well, you know, they can find me on randallhorton.com, and they can always request a book there, a signed copy. And I, you know, but the book comes out with Northwestern University Press, and so you can always go to their website and get it. I appreciate the support there. That always helps, you know, getting it straight from, you know, them. But, you know, it's available on a lot of Barnes & Nobles, on all the online platforms, Amazon, Barnes & Nobles. Yeah, so the gamut in terms of that. So recently, I guess, yeah, recently, not so recently, it was in January, I just received what they call the Creative Capital Artists Award, right? And so what it's going to enable. So I have a poetry band, man. It's called Radical Reversal, right?
It's awesome.
Yeah. And so one of the things we're going to do is we're going to put turn four classrooms into in four prisons into these creative spaces with recording studios, right? It's going to be recording studio / performance / creative space. So they're going to allow us to basically trick out a whole classroom. You know what I mean? So we're going to be in Minnesota, Massachusetts, and Connecticut. And we're going to do programming for like 2 years, and we're going to record up there, and we're going to do some live performances. And we're hoping to actually live stream a collaborative effort from, you know, both all of the places that we work in each one to live stream it, you know, through various social justice channels, platforms on the outside. So we'll see. But that's the plan. But we're going to be doing the program, and we partnered with like four social, you know, some organizations that are doing work in these places already. So that's our infrastructure. And so we're trying to provide, this whole creative experience, man, in the rehabilitative process. And, you know, thinking about other ways in which we create, ways in which we can rehabilitate the mind and the body, you know, and as we prepare, you know, people to go back into society. You know, a lot of times it's just not about in education. You know, I mean, the educational component is cool. I get that. But sometimes it's about creativity and about like allowing yourself to sort of imagine some other stuff and think outside of yourself. Even if you're not going to be, you know, a musician or a writer or a poet, that's not even the issue, man. That's like secondary, but maybe third on the list of what we're trying to do. You know, we're trying to, you know, provide an experience in which people feel good about themselves, man. So.
Well, it was an absolute pleasure chatting with you, and really cool hearing about the way that you're still, you know, beyond the book, working on changing some narratives and changing some minds, because that's incredibly important. Randall, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Jay. I appreciate it, man. And thanks for having me on. It's been great talking with you.